From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast, and this is Maryland Morning. Baltimore has less than a third as many kids in foster care as were there 7 years ago, which means more kids with their families. We asked City Social Services Director Molly McGrath Tierney what's behind the change and what happens next. Then, several years ago, iconic filmmaker John Waters stepped out of his home in Baltimore armed with a travel bag and a cardboard sign. He spent the next 8 days hitchhiking cross-country to his apartment in San Francisco. He talks with Tom Hall about the adventure he found on the road. Plus, the glory days of manufacturing in Baltimore are long over. So what can be done with the factory buildings left behind? We ask urban planner Andy Cook how light manufacturing could be the answer. First, the news.
I'm producer Jonna McCone. To catch the news, you'll need to listen to us live on Monday, Wednesday, and Friday mornings at 9 o'clock on 88.1 FM in Baltimore and Frederick, 106.9 in Ocean City, and streaming online at wypr.org/listen. Now, on with the show.
Good morning. It's Maryland Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In 2007, more than 6,000 children in Baltimore were in foster care, 6,275. This year, the number of children in foster care has slipped below 2,000, a reduction of more than two-thirds. At a time when so many aspects of Baltimore are coming under scrutiny, this positive trend seems worth talking about. And with me in the studio is Molly McGrath Tierney. Except for 10 months last year, she has headed the Baltimore City Department of Social Services since 2008. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you told me the number of kids in foster care in Baltimore probably has not been this low since the 1970s.
That's my guess. The sort of modern way of counting began probably in the late 80s, early 90s. And the most accurate I can get is in about 98 or 99, there were 9,000 kids in foster care in Baltimore City.
So walk me through how the conventional wisdom has changed about kids who are abused and neglected, changed from, say, 10 years ago to now.
So in a word, significantly, there was, if we went back to the 90s, you know, we all remember the crack epidemic and some real challenges in our economy. And this got us to, in the field of child protection, belief that the first thing to do at the sign of trouble in a family is to take a kid into foster care, and then the next thing to do is to keep them there. And so we had a lot of kids that came into foster care and spent their entire childhoods there, and there was also a professional preference for kids living in group homes or congregate settings. So that's how it was. And there was, I'm happy to say, the benefit of hindsight in more recent years that had a bunch of folks from all across the country noticing that didn't really turn out that well for a lot of those kids and families. And now there's a decided preference for the idea we could keep more kids safely at home. And if they come into foster care, we could get them back out to their own families or to a family they could call their own, an adoptive home. And that while they're in foster care, it's in our best interest to have them living with a family and not in a group home.
You worked in child protective work. I mean, you were in Illinois,
correct,
in Chicago.
And in Washington, D.C.
Right. So
yes.
you're bringing like decades,
yes,
into this. So when you got to Baltimore, what did you do?
Well, fell in love with the place, first of all, and began to act on a belief that we could work backwards from a different kind of result, work backwards from, of course, every kid could be in a family. Of course, we could keep more kids safely at home. And of course, if they come into foster care, we can get them back out very quickly. And so the to-dos based on working back from that finish line were many. You know, we used data to understand our work, and we became very mission-oriented and clear about what we believed. And we got very focused on what are the concrete steps we have to take working backwards from that finish line to get there in a reasonable time frame.
And what are those concrete steps?
Well, you know, a lot of this work is more art than science, but there is sort of things we can do the minute a family comes to our attention. that first work very hard to, is there things we can put in place that could keep a kid safe at home? If we can, great, that's our preference. And to be near a family, near enough to help make sure that that's sustainable over time. If a kid comes into foster care, things we do in the earliest moments, make sure they're with a family, make sure they're visiting their parents, make sure we're figuring out a lot of their extended family members so that while a kid is in foster care, we can reduce the level of trauma that child has experienced. We can make sure every kid that comes into foster care only has one placement and not many, many, many placements. And we can take lots of actions, whether it's in court or working with a parent or getting them connected to some kind of service, that would mean we were resolving the issue that brought the kid into foster care. Maybe not solving all the world's problems, but making it safe for that kid to be home.
Give me an example.
So a family could come to our attention because maybe there was domestic violence and there might have been some violence in the home. And that might have made us think, oh, well, it's just not safe to leave a kid there. And so what we would need to do is work with the parents on anger management or substance abuse or the selection of partners that would reduce violence in a home or understanding the impact it has on children, such that we believed there wasn't going to be violence in a home that was going to make a kid unsafe. That family might also be low income. That kid might not have its very own separate bedroom. It might not be going to be getting bused to the very best school across town, but that wasn't what brought the kid into foster care. And it's really easy in child welfare to drift, to say, oh, well, now the kid's come in. It came in because somebody popped the kid on the head and there was a, you know, reason to believe the kid wasn't safe. But that's the end we think, oh, well, we can't send the kid back until the mom has a bigger house, until the dad's working at this level of income, until a bunch of other things had been solved. I think, yeah, but it's our job isn't to solve all the world's problems. It's to focus on how do we keep kids safe with their own families, or a family that believes that kid is theirs, and a family to whom that child believes that they belong. There's overwhelming research for more than a century to show we would rather have a kid in a family that loved that kid more than anything, that was totally devoted to caring for that kid and had the conceptual belief that this kid is one of us, than to have the kid in another setting where there might be a great many more resources and lots more money and fancy clothes and fancy schools and new cars and a whole bunch of other trappings that we all seek because we watch too much MTV. But we'd really rather, we're really focused on how do we get a kid in a family they can believe is theirs.
That's Molly McGrath Tierney here on Maryland Morning 88.1. I'm Sheila Cass. She is director of the Baltimore City Department of Social Services, and we're talking about a two-thirds drop over the last 8 years in the number of kids in Baltimore in foster care. How do you know that you are not leaving kids in peril?
Well, we look at that pretty carefully. So we watched this growth very slowly over time. We didn't do it in a year. We did it over many years. And we carefully track children who didn't come into the system, who we kept safely at home, to see if in later years they did come in. And kids who left the system, did they come back in? Do we have sort of a revolving door problem? And the answer is overwhelmingly no. The kids we're able to keep safe at home are still safe at home. And the kids we either sent home or sent to adoption, they are safely in families. They're just regular people now.
I found a TED Talk mm-hmm. that you gave January a year ago.
Yep.
And we will post it on our website. You ticked off accomplishments very similar to what we've been talking about today, where these stats stood a year ago. And the audience was kind of applauding or praising. And you said, no, not really. You said, quote, foster care is a bad idea. Close quote.
So what I believe after 25 years of doing this work, so what I thought, as I said in my TED Talk, what I thought when I came to Baltimore for this tremendous opportunity, is I believed that if we could fix this system, then we'd get to help people. And I really looked forward to that. And that was sort of the horse trading I did, is I'll fix the system. And then we'll get to really impact people's lives. And what I learned is the intervention that we're using to serve families that we were using then, the intervention we used then here in Baltimore City in 2007, if a family needed help, what we did is we took their kids. And so what I mean to say by foster care is a bad idea, it's the idea that the thing to do when a family's in trouble is take their children should be called into question. Because there's just, we keep doing it, but there's not a lot of evidence it's helping. And I think there's a great deal more anecdote and evidence being brought to bear that we can do work as an organization and as a community to keep families whole and then to raise children to be productive citizens. And I'm pleased to say I think we're on that track in Baltimore City.
And I worry a bit mm-hmm. about this aspect when we celebrate a big drop in foster care. What message does that send to foster parents?
Oh, well, I hope it sends a message of gratitude. I hope it sends a message to the community that, so about half the kids that come into foster care go home to their parents, and the other half get adopted and go and help some household build a family. That's by water and branches, not blood and roots. And I hope it sends a message that we're, as a community, building lots of families in lots of kinds of ways here in Baltimore City that made a huge difference to all those children that were adopted. And that because of the way our system works now, if a family comes in, calls me up and says, okay, I would like to be a foster parent, we're really clear. So we don't just do foster parents anymore. We do foster and adoptive parents. So if we're going to put a kid into your home and you're going to be the foster parent, then one of two things is going to happen. We're going to ask you to help us get that kid reunified to their own family. And if that doesn't work, we're going to ask you to adopt. And once that foster home adopts and they become an adoptive home, they're not a foster home anymore. And so someone else steps up. And so we've continued to invite more people into our foster parent community who are doing a tremendous job of caring for children under very difficult circumstances.
What happens next? You gave me a chart that shows this mm-hmm. steady line over mm-hmm. 7 years of declining numbers of yeah. kids in foster care. Does that go to zero? What happens?
I don't know if it'll ever be at zero, although it's important to conceptually to imagine that as a possibility. I hope for Baltimore that it becomes a very small number and that for any child who comes in, it is very brief that they're in foster care. The what's next is us all figuring out as a community, how can we get to a family who needs us at the earliest sign of trouble? Right? Because if you thought of a family whose kid comes into foster care, if you drew the arc on a graph, their decline, they're sort of, you might imagine the lines going fine at the top of the graph, and then they just start to tip, and they're tipping for a little bit, and then it is a precipitous drop into a perilous situation that probably isn't just I lost my kid, but also my home, my job, my spouse, like everything is pretty awful. The challenge is, if you imagine that graph in your mind's eye, that child welfare intervenes after the precipitous drop. And I imagine
that's what happens now.
That's what happens. We intervene at the end of the precipitous drop. Oh, well, everything's really bad now. I'm going to have to come and dig your kid. If we could all figure out, how would we know a family's just beginning to tip? And how would we as a community intervene then? And what would that look like? Is it the second time someone calls 211 for food? Is it the first time a 9-year-old shows up at an ER for a psychiatric hospitalization? Is it when your BG&E gets cut off and we know you have kids in your home? I don't know, but I feel like there's lots of mining that we can be doing as a community, and I really do feel like Baltimore's poised to do that.
Interesting idea. Thank you.
Thank you.
Molly McGrath-Tierney, for most of the last 7 years, she's headed the Baltimore City Department of Social Services. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay tuned for John Waters.
Do you have thoughts on that segment you just heard? Email us at mdmorning@wypr.org or find us on Twitter. We're at Maryland Morning. Now back to the show.
On 88.1, it's Maryland Morning. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us this morning. Want to let you know that the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance announced last week the winners of this year's 2015 Baker Artist Awards. Three folks won the Mary Sawyer's Baker Prize. That's Paul Rucker. He's a visual artist, composer, and musician. Wendell Patrick is a composer and music producer. And Eric Dyer is a filmmaker. They won the $25,000 Mary Sawyer's Baker Prize. They also announced 2015 B Grant winners. There are three of those. Renee Rendine is an installation artist. Dominic Zeltzman is also a video and installation artist. And Timmy Reed is a writer. So those three won the B Grant Awards. These are awards made possible by the William G. Baker Jr. Memorial Fund, and they are administered by the Greater Baltimore Cultural Alliance. Now, the summer solstice is a month away, but summer unofficially kicks off this weekend with this Memorial Day holiday. And as a public service, John Waters is here, and my guess is that he'll recommend a book that he thinks should definitely be on your summer reading list. He happens to have written it himself. It's his seventh book. It's a bestseller that he released last year, and it's now available in paperback. It's called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. Hey, John, good to see you.
I'm well. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Welcome back.
Good.
So tell folks how you've divided the book. There are three sections. The last section tells what actually happened on the 8-day hitchhiking tour. What about the first two?
Well, before I left, every person I knew said, don't do this. Are you crazy? The worst stuff's going to happen. And I kept thinking, God, I wasn't nervous before, but then I thought, maybe I should. What is the best that can happen? And what's the worst? So I dreamed it up. It was like writing 30 movies, because it's 15 great rides and 15 terrible rides. Terrible rides, always. What happens to the worst thing you can imagine if you're hitchhiking? Diarrhea, and you get murdered. So it was fun to write.
In that
order.
In
my own murder. Yeah, I wrote my own murder. And then really, I barely finished it before I left, so the first draft of it. So after I wrote my murder, like 3 days later, I hitchhiked. I thought, well, how much worse could it be, really? It gave me confidence to go do it. And in real life, nothing was as dramatic as that, but the people were wonderful. And since this book has come out, I have kept up with a lot of them. And I'm going to be in the Corvette Kid's wedding.
Terrific. Now, tell us about the Corvette Kid. He's a guy from Myersville, Maryland.
Yeah,
he
was a Republican elected official. He did not run again. I think he figured they'd use this against him.
You can imagine the ads.
Yeah, he was going to the subway to get his lunch. I was hitchhiking in the pouring rain, and he picked me up in his mother's Corvette. He had no idea who I was. He even told me, never heard any of my movies, never saw anything. And we just kept talking, and he drove me to Ohio, much to his parents' freaking out. You know, when you Google me, it isn't friendly to a parent.
Right.
And then he came back, and then I got stuck. I kept going. He kept tweeting. And then he drove 48 hours at 80 miles an hour and came back and picked me up in Denver and took me a few more states. And so we became friends. I'm going to be in his wedding. I think it was good for his confidence. He looks great.
He was 20 years old at the time. Yeah. This is a couple of years ago.
He didn't run for office again.
Right.
He's getting married, has a beautiful new girlfriend. He looks great. He comes to my Christmas party every year. So, and I've been in touch with a lot of them. The Marine woman that picked me up, she had a baby and named the middle name after me.
That's
the
terrific.
Rock and roll band that picked me up, I've had dinner with. The preacher's wife that picked me up in Baltimore.
Here we
even
go,
met
magic.
My mother.
Yeah, here we go, magic is the name of the band.
Here we go, magic.
They were the ones that sort of let the cat out of the bag
yes.
when you started this odyssey. You had kept it very secret.
Well, I kept it secret. Even when they did, they said, can we tweet it? I said, sure. You can do whatever you want. But when it went viral in the story, still the New York Times was calling my apartment. I never said that I did it till I got there, and it was over with. And
so the idea, we should make sure folks understand, you hitchhiked from your house in Baltimore
to my apartment in San Francisco.
Yeah.
And 21 rides, 9 days. And I've met, after, you know, going around the country promoting this book for a year, basically, most all people my age did hitchhike in their life, and they remember it fondly. They wouldn't do it today. And most all young people never have hitchhiked and want to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they like the idea of it. But when I was young, it wasn't even thought as bad to hitchhike. My parents expected me to hitchhike home after school. It wasn't a terrible thing.
They weren't about to come pick you up, right?
Well, yeah. And I mean,
they weren't either. Yeah, I agree.
They thought it was fine too. I mean, you know, I remember seeing all the kids with lacrosse sticks hitchhiking home from private schools and stuff. I went to Catholic school, which was the perverts came to pick up those kids. But the same perverts and killers were out there, I guess. Just nobody wrote about them.
Yeah.
But nothing ever bad happened to me hitchhiking, and nothing ever bad happened on this trip either.
Yeah, I mean,
really.
did you ever feel in danger? I mean, as I read the book, it seemed to me that one of the biggest challenges you faced was the tedium. I mean, there were a couple of days there where you're standing out there in bad weather, you know.
For 10 hours
for,
one
you
day.
Know, yeah, I mean, that's a long time to stand there. Just the tedium of being
Do you
there.
Know how many cars go by in 10 hours?
Yeah. And you can't read, you can't
no,
do anything.
I didn't even look at my phone because it's too bright. You can't really look at yourself. And I never, when I got in the car, I thought the rudest thing, there are hitchhiking manners. When you get in the car, if you take out your phone, you're like a jerk, really. And there were, even though I imagined in the best and worst ride music, there's even a playlist at the back of the book about hitchhiking songs, not one person had the radio on. When you pick up somebody hitchhiking, you don't have the radio and you want to talk.
Sure.
And you let the manners is how much you want to talk or let them talk. I wanted them to talk. I didn't want to tell my stories. I do interviews all the time for my work. And it, fascinatingly enough, the people, the pick-me-up in middle America didn't want to even talk about celebrity, even if they knew who I were. They weren't interested. They wanted to tell their story. Mm-hmm. And I didn't have a tape recorder. As soon as I got out of every car, I wrote everything down that I could remember.
And you say that you write at one point that when you're hitchhiking, your usual value system collapses. And this was in the context of a woman who didn't initially recognize you, yeah. And she started giving you a hard time, and then she figured out who you were, and then once that happened, then she starts being nice to you.
Well, that is the only thing I hate. If people, I'm used to, I would say 80% of the time I'm an airport, people do recognize me, right? But they don't always say something, but you can tell. I can immediately tell. People, when they think, if they think you're famous, they think you're invisible, because I see people go, hey, look, 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 look. I can see you doing that. But they act like I'm Harvey or something, you know, the ghost that famous people don't see that you're acting ludicrous because they recognize you. But the worst is when you're checking into an airplane or something and the woman is crappy to you. She's not nice. I mean, she doesn't know who you are. And then suddenly she sees your name and gets and then acts nice. I hate them.
Yeah.
I don't mind if they're mean the whole time.
Right.
But don't change because you suddenly, or the worst is when people say, can I have your picture? But they don't know who you are. Someone else recognizes me. I said, well, why do you want my autograph if you don't know who I am? That's how bad it's gotten about fame
it's
in America.
It's a celebrity
yeah.
obsession.
Could be worse. Yeah. High class problem.
But I mean, did you change at all? I mean, as your value system evolved now that you've made this trip? I mean,
my value system changed. Hitchhiking. Well, I said before I would never get on a motorcycle. I would have gotten in with Ted Bundy if he pulled up in a Volkswagen with his arm in his sling. I would have hopped in after 10 hours. I imagined if I was ever frightened, I was going to say, you know, I'm filming a reality show and there's a satellite filming it, but it's on me. If you leave, that might have worked. But I never was frightened of anybody ever. Mm. People were great. And they didn't all know who I was. Certainly they didn't. And some picked me up and then figured it out, or they thought I was a homeless man. I kind of was.
And there were a couple of people who simply wouldn't be convinced. There was a farmer in his 80s who just figured you were.
I showed him a film director. He was like, sure, this poor homeless guy. He tried to give me money. It was very touching.
Yeah. John Waters' new book is in paperback. It's called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America on 88.1. I'm Tom Hall. You're listening to Marilyn Morning. So the reaction to this book has really been something.
It's been great. You know, it was, I've been on the New York Times bestseller list. It was on the San Francisco bestseller list for even I was above Hillary, and hers was called Hard Choices. People thought that was a porn title. But I was...
No, they didn't.
I did. When I first saw it, I thought it was. We were in San Francisco, you got to remember. no, it was great. And it's, you know, it's amazing to me because the book is fairly insane in parts. And you think this is a bestseller. God, times have changed. That this is a book that regular people are reading and seemingly, no one seems to get upset about anything I do anymore, which I love. I never was trying to just upset people anyway. But I haven't changed that much. If you read the chapters in Carsick, could be very much the early fictitious chapters, could be some of my early movies completely.
Sure.
And a couple of them were movie ideas that I put in. So, but no one seems anymore to be upset about it, which is nice, I think. It's nice.
Yeah. I mean... Are any of the fantasies that you had, either the good ones or the bad ones, were they ones that were sort of long-standing, or were these ones that you invented on
Well, I never had sex in a demolition derby car in the middle of a race, but once, for
but
all
you
things
thought about it.
Yes, because for all things considered, I did cover once the demolition derby and was in the car with someone. Now,
you came that close.
That didn't happen, but it was. Yeah, things trigger ideas. Let's put it that way.
Right.
It's all based on something. I mean, the hipster carnival thing was sort of based on a movie idea I had once. the crazy librarian that goes around distributing uncollectible books to insane readers. I own all those books. I mean, so a lot of it's
yes,
a little
bit. Yes, you spoke with great
me.
Authority yeah. when you wrote about these titles.
Yeah,
I think this, he's got to be making these up.
No, they're all true titles.
Yeah. So it really does run the gamut. And some of it is pretty racy stuff. So this is not a book you give your 11-year-old, I
now,
guess.
No, unless they're... have a good sense of humor. Even the porn star, when I have the scene with Connie Francis and I have a magic part of my body, I don't know if he ever read it, you know. But you don't know. I don't know if Connie Francis read it. I mean, she's treated certainly in a fictitious way. But I did meet Connie Francis, and she was a little like that.
Yeah, well, Connie Francis, that was actually one of my favorite chapters. I thought, was this inspired by any of these, like, you know, on the road movies or books or anything like that?
Well, sure. You know, even though you think about on the road, they didn't hitchhike that much. They were in cars a lot. They hitchhiked a little. It was inspired because I hitchhiked a lot when I was young, never across the country. The longest I ever did was San Francisco to LA and Baltimore to Provincetown. But in Provincetown, in the last 10 years, I hitchhiked every summer by myself. That's what gave me the idea, because there was this beach I loved called Long Nook, and you can only go there if you have a sticker and live there full time. So I couldn't drive there, and it's like 10 miles. So I would hitchhike every day. And then I had dates, you know, want to come hitchhiking with me. You know, I did it with Patty Hearst. I did it with other people. And so it became kind of a fun thing. And in Provincetown, it was easy. People recognized me. But coming back, you were really on Route 6, which is the highway. So that was real hitchhiking, kind of. Not as real as a ramping Kansas by myself for 10 hours.
Now, you know, you're on the road all the time. I mean, you have homes in San Francisco and here in Baltimore and New York, so you're a left and right coast guy. But you've been to the middle of the country a lot of times, you know, doing your stand-up and you know, traveling. Did you get a different view of the middle of the country because you did it literally from entrances to the interstate?
Yes, I did because, well, first of all, driving across the country is the most amazing experience that everybody should do. I did it when I was young, all five different routes. We used to get drive-away cars, they were called, where you'd look, they'd have it out in the New York Times, and you'd call up, and they'd give you your car, and you'd drive it to California and deliver it to the house. Why anyone gave me a car with what I looked like during those years, and we always had drugs, pot, and five other people in the car, but they always got their car. I never ripped it off. You know, we did the job. But so I had a remembering that very much, you know, wanting to do that. And so to drive across the country, the thing was that what you always think, joke, middle America, something that I'm really not much in. I'm in the high and low. I'm not much in the middle. But every one of those people was the opposite of what the cliche, what liberal people think that middle Americans are. They were not closed-minded. They were not predictable at all either, though. You know, you couldn't quite tell what they believed in. But maybe that's people that pick up hitchhikers are people that have usually conquered something. They've struggled. They've gotten over something. They're doing well now, and they want to help somebody else.
Did you talk to any of them about that? You didn't write too much about it in the book, but did you say to them, you know, why did you pick somebody up? Isn't it dangerous for you, the driver?
No, I never asked that. You never say the same thing you never ask.
You don't want to plant anything
when
in
you
their
go
minds,
in to pitch a movie. If they say no, you ask. If they say yes, you never ask. Just get out right before they change their mind. That's like in a car, you don't want to ask, and they pull over and say, get out. Once somebody pulled up, and then I pulled over, and then they said, never mind, when they saw me. I thought, well, isn't that an insult? And then another time somebody picked up a father and two kids, but they were only going two exits. And the local rides are your enemy because you're in a good place and you don't want to be left off at a worse place. And they were very kind.
Yeah, because you had to be very strategic about where you stood with the sign.
That's the hardest, where you get dropped off. Yeah. And I had the best luck in the middle of the country. Not in truck stops are the worst because trucks can't pick you up anymore. They have two drivers, one sleeping and one's there. I got one ride in a truck, but he was great. But not the ones with the fast food places, the ones that are little parks that where people stop and walk their dogs and stuff, because A, they exit and enter there very slowly, and they get a chance to see you stand there for a while, and they're going far places usually. It gets easier. The worst is cities. You can't go near cities. You have to get dropped off after the city, not right before, because it's all local rides. Mm-hmm. And then the worse you get in the city, there's nowhere to hitchhike and no one's going far. You need to be in one of those parks. People are driving far, at least sort of far.
You talk a lot in the book about, you know, movie ideas you had or movies you had done and stuff. There's a yearning here for that you that seems pretty obvious to me, reading, is that you really are missing making movies. You're doing so many other things.
I actually think you're wrong.
Really? Because I picked up, oh, gosh, there is. It's another movie reference or something. Because one of the fantasies is a drug dealer gives you money to fund the movie that you've had written now for some years that you've had a tough time finding.
Yes, and I have a development deal that I can't talk about right now for a whole other TV project. We'll see if it happens. If it doesn't happen, I like writing books equally as making movies. I mean, it's just me. I don't have to have 500 people. I have 15 movies. I just had a huge retrospective at Lincoln Center. I'm having a huge one at the British Film Institute in the fall. It's not like I haven't spoken. My movies are all available. They play on TV. Who would have ever thought any of them would play on TV? So if I never make another movie again, I am not sitting home yearning. My dreams were fulfilled years ago. But I want to make another one, and I still do it. And but I liked writing this book as much as I ever had making a movie, and the book was a hit, and my last movie wasn't.
John Waters, his latest book is now available in paperback. It's called Carsick, John Waters Hitchhikes Across America. There's a release party and book signing at Atomic Books in Hamden next Thursday night, 7 o'clock. We've got a link with all the details on our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. On 88.1, it's Marilyn Morning with Sheila Cast. I'm Tom Hall. We're very grateful to everybody who's made a pledge before we begin our spring pledge drive. The on-air drive is scheduled to begin next week. We'll have to interrupt some of Marilyn Morning and other programs when we do that, but you can help us interrupt that particular plan. Come to WIPR.org and show your support for conversations like the one I've just had with John Waters. As soon as we reach our goal, the pledge drive will be over. If enough of us pledge right now, we may not have to interrupt any programs at all next week. So come to WIPR.org and show your support for your public radio. There's lots more coming up on Marilyn Morning. Stay with us.
If you want to join in on the conversation, go to our website, wypr.org/Marilyn Morning, and make a comment. We'd love to hear from you. You can also check out our audio archives there and learn more about what you just heard, or even make a pledge to support local programming. That's all at wypr.org/Marilyn Morning. Now, back to the show.
This is Marilyn Morning on 88.1. I'm Sheila Cast. In the latter half of the last century, Baltimore lost roughly 100,000 manufacturing jobs. The factories shuttered, but the buildings remained, many of them clustered in desolate stretches of industrially zoned areas in southwest Baltimore. Like other former industrial cities along the East Coast, Baltimore is trying to figure out how to regain its manufacturing footing. The big factories may not return to their former use, but can other types of businesses blossom? And if so, what role can these shuttered factories play? That's a question Andy Cook has been asking. As an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer, he's working as an urban planner in the Baltimore City Planning Department. He's creating a database of former industrial buildings and sites across the city. So far, he's noticed about half of them are in southwest Baltimore, and he's got ideas about how they could be redeveloped. Along with the nonprofits Baltimore Heritage and Housing Policy Watch, Cook is organizing a tour of a few sites in southwest Baltimore next Friday. And Andy Cook joins me in the studio. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So paint us a picture of the kinds of industrial buildings in southwest Baltimore that we're talking about.
Well, when I think of these buildings, the first one that comes to mind is my favorite, the sort of most iconic. It's the Eigenbrot Brewery. It's built in the mid-1870s, kind of a German Gothic sort of architecture. It's from an era when they built industrial buildings with a lot of care, and they built them to last. There's a lot of great, like, detail to this building, and while it certainly looks rough around the edges, so to speak, some trees growing out of it in places, it's still in remarkably good shape. And a lot of the buildings sort of in the area mirror that quality. They're built from a time when people really cared about, you know, the detail of the architecture of these buildings.
So beer is one of the products that used to come from these buildings. What are some other kinds of manufacturing?
Southwest Baltimore was really a food hub of Baltimore back in around the turn of the century. There were a lot of breweries, there were a lot of butcheries, and there were a lot of bakeries. And a lot of it was run sort of by the German population that had settled there.
Tell us more about the shape that these buildings are in.
There, you know, many of them have been abandoned for decades. In looking at the region as a whole, not all of them, I think, are necessarily suited for new industrial uses. Some of them just need to be torn down. But there are a few, and that's the ones that we're going to be visiting on our tour, that are in good enough shape that I think redevelopment is a real option.
What's the end point that you envision? What kind of use? What activity?
Well, you know, these buildings were originally built for production of goods. And I think that those kinds of jobs are the kinds of jobs that Baltimoreans need. It's a sad reality that 75% of the people living in Baltimore don't have college degrees. And so the jobs available to them tend to be in like retail or sort of the service industry, which unfortunately don't pay great wages. They're usually not full time. They usually don't have benefits. Jobs in manufacturing and other kinds of goods production industries tend to be the opposite. They're full-time jobs. They have benefits. They pay a living wage. So we're hoping, or I'm hoping, that these buildings will be homes for jobs like that. I'd like to see small goods-producing businesses sort of populate these structures.
That's Andy Cook, an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer working as an urban planner in the Baltimore City Planning Department here on WIPR, Maryland Morning. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about how abandoned industrial sites in southwest Baltimore could be redeveloped. The first thing that I thought of when I heard about the tour you're putting together is incubators. We've seen incubators pop up around the country, including here in Baltimore. Would that be a logical thing to sort of be nurturing startups?
Definitely. Right now, you know, the city, we have the Emerging Technology Center, which is like a tech startup incubator on the east side. I would love to see a manufacturing incubator happen on the west side. Other cities have done this. Chicago has an example of one of these. Baltimore even used to have things like this back in sort of the heyday of the Industrial Revolution. There's a building, it's now an apartment building over just barely on the east side, that was a manufacturing incubator back around the turn of the century, essentially a place where there are resources, tools, you know, cheap, affordable space for companies to get their start if they don't have a lot of capital. So I think, yes, I think incubators are a great idea. And, you know, they should be targeted to certain kinds of industries as well to really sort of maximize the ability of businesses to share resources.
Like what?
Well, for instance, two of the biggest, fastest growing small manufacturing subsectors in Baltimore right now are food and apparel. And there's talk about a food business incubator happening on the east side right now. I would love to see something focused on the fashion industry. You know, there's also, of course, a lot of talk about advanced manufacturing and new technologies that are allowing goods to be produced cheaper and cleaner, things like 3D printing and laser cutting. And those kinds of tools are being used a lot in the makerspaces that we see popping up in the city. Makerspaces are kind of just places that have these tools. People can sign up sort of in like a YMCA kind of model just to use the space whenever they have a project that they want to try or to learn some of these tools. I think that an incubator is kind of the next step in that process. So once someone has, you know, maybe been working in a makerspace and learning how to, like, I don't know, make some widget on a 3D printer, they decide that this is something that they could actually market, then maybe there would be a manufacturing incubator that could support them, give them the sort of business advice and resources that they would need to take it off the ground.
So there's really kind of two kinds of rebirth you're talking about. I mean, one would be the redevelopment rebirth of individual buildings, but you're also talking about trying to actually get a whole sector of the economy going again. What are the biggest barriers?
I think there's a number. In looking at, you know, the kind of work we're trying to see happen in Southwest Baltimore, of course, cost of redeveloping these properties is a huge barrier, and uncertainty of cost as well. You look at one of these buildings that's in pretty rough shape, it's clear that it needs a lot of work, but it's not clear exactly how much. And I think that uncertainty tends to make people shy away from projects like that. So figuring out a way to maybe quantify just what it would take to get one of these buildings back online is something that could, I think, remove a barrier. Another piece of this that I think is a big barrier is also just the way the perception of industry in communities. You know, when you use the word industrial, people have a they have an image in their mind of like smoke pouring out of a smokestack, and it's dirty, and there's a lot of big trucks, and, you know, perhaps it's unhealthy. And so communities, I think, tend to resist industrial type uses in their backyards.
But this area already is zoned industrial.
Yeah, all the buildings we're visiting are zoned industrial, but they are very close to residences. And so I think that, you know, a major barrier is showing people what these new manufacturing practices are, showing them that they are not yesterday's industry. They're not steel mills. They're doing things that are environmentally safe. They're doing things that are quiet. And if they're talking about small businesses, we're not talking about like giant trucks. We're talking about smaller trucks. We're talking about less traffic. So it's kind of painting a picture of what the kinds of businesses we're talking about are, the kind of potential for the kinds of businesses we're talking about.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Andy Cook. He's an AmeriCorps Vista volunteer who works as an urban planner in the Baltimore City Planning Department. The tour of several vacant industrial sites in southwest Baltimore that he's organized along with the nonprofits Baltimore Heritage and Housing Policy Watch, that's next Friday morning at 10, a week from now. Tickets are $20. We've got more information on our website, wypr.org/Maryland Morning. Maryland Morning is an original production
of your public radio,
WYPR,
in Baltimore.
The show is produced by Matt Purdy
and Jonna McCone.
Nathan Sterner directs and engineers.
Coffee for our guests provided by Zeke's Coffee in Lauraville. On the web at ZEKESCoffee.com.
I'm Tom Hall.
And I'm Sheila Cast. In the early to mid-1800s, Baltimore was a hotspot for conventions where political parties nominated their presidential candidates. On this day in history, 1848, the Democratic Party held its national convention in Baltimore and nominated Michigan Senator Lewis Cass. Cass went on to be defeated in the general election by the Whig Party's Zachary Taylor, the 12th president. We're back on Monday. Hope you'll share some of your Memorial Day with us.